Welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. My name is Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
I almost broke into sneakers. My voice is my passport.
Verify me.
Yeah. Anyway, a lot going on in the world of sports. Sometimes I have a hard time focusing. I don't know if everybody noticed that so far. We do have a really awesome guest this week that Hansen ran into in the grocery store. Just goes to prove that Cy Young Award winners do exist in the wild.
The wild of Bedford.
Chris Carpenter will be joining us. It's shocking to me that it took us that long to consider getting him on the air.
Yeah, very exciting. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, so we'll talk to him about a variety of things. The first is, here's a footnote for you. I didn't even occur to you. You saw my excitement on my face. That means that we will have had the only two first-round draft picks from the state of New Hampshire for the Major League Baseball draft on our show.
Within about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. I'm just saying. That's all. So speaking of one that we like to talk about, Grant Levine, who...
The most recent of the two.
...is tearing up the Pioneer League. And it's funny, the conversations that you have with people about baseball who may or may not be as intimately familiar with the world of minor league baseball as you are or I am, who go, Pioneer League, so this means he's going to be up in the majors by the end of the year? I'm like, let's not put the cart way before the horse or the entire team of horses, but, as it were, but he's tearing it up.
Yeah, then if you see his stats, right, then you might start to think, well, of course he's going to play in the major leagues. He's hitting 390.
Well, you look at the weird stuff and you say, all right, the Nats have Juan Soto, but it's not fair to compare an American player to a foreign player, where a foreign player can sign at 16 and play in minor leagues in their country and kind of get pushed along in a different fashion than an American player would, when a kid has to either finish up with high school or play at a JUCO or be in his junior year coming out of college for all intents and purposes. It's still impressive. And to the question that people always ask, well, the Pioneer League, who's he competing against? And where does that rank in the hierarchy of minor leagues? And we've talked about that. It's rookie ball. So rookie ball, short A, low A, high A, double A, triple A majors. That's kind of the super condensed version. The most important thing when I'm looking at this, though, is Baseball Reference, which is probably my favorite website, just hands down. And it's a rabbit hole that I have to occasionally, like I should have little electric pads on my keyboard, so I just stop. But if you've never been to baseballreference.com, they have gone through somehow and pulled in stats basically from the dawn of time. And minor league stats, when guys were playing in just bizarre little tiny outposts in North Carolina or when Santa Barbara, California had a team. And they've done a really good job of putting this all together. One of the things that they have, in addition to the regular stats and the advanced metrics, is an age differential. Have you looked at this yet?
No.
So what do you think, Grant's 18, what do you think the age differential between him and the average Pioneer League player is?
Well, perhaps he's, on average, 2 years younger.
Okay, my guess would have been year and a half-ish. 2.6 years younger. So you have Grant, who is going to turn 19 at the end of next month. And the average kid is going to be basically between, on the high end of 21. For all intents and purposes, you're talking about kids who are in their junior year of college, were age not to be a factor, facing a kid that is, what, less than a month removed from his high school graduation. That's pretty cool.
That's awesome. And 2.5 years at that stage of a professional baseball's career is,
right,
like, in baseball years, dog years, it'd be like 6 years. That's major amount of time at that stage.
It takes a lot. And you look at the roster, the average roster for Grand Junction, the average age is 20.6. There's a guy kicking around who's 25 who may have been an injury guy that they just wanted to get a little time to before they sent him off to somewhere else. So that's not necessarily a fair comparison. But, I mean, most of these kids are drinking age or close to it.
Yeah.
So it is a... a big difference for him to be there compared to here. And also, when you look at the pitchers compared to the hitters, as it pans out for the league, the pitchers are typically older than the hitters are. So, not by a lot, but slightly more seasoned, as it were.
So, the age difference and the fact that he's a hitter transitioning to Wood, we talked about how, you know, pitchers have an easier transition because now all of a sudden they have an extra advantage with the hitters, you know, adjusting to Wood. That just makes it doubly more impressive that he's batting 390 with three homers and 15 RBIs in his first 10 games, including a seven-game hit streak. He's only had two games where he hasn't gotten a hit.
It's way more than I would have expected in the early going because it is an adjustment. It's an adjustment being away from home, and it's an adjustment in so many ways, but no doubt from knowing him and knowing his dad over the years, approached it professionally. You have to have fun because it is fun, but you also have to treat it like it's a job. And there are high expectations placed on your head when you are the first round draft pick, regardless of where you're from. And I have to imagine it's probably a little bit cool too, knowing that you have an entire town of people that look in the bulletin or the journal every week trying to catch up with what's going on or listen to us maybe.
Right. Well, that, maybe. Yeah, we're here for everybody.
Yeah. You know,
make it easy.
We try. So, Grant Levine is, like you said, 390 in the Pioneer League in the early going. I certainly hope he has an opportunity to play in that league's All-Star game. But it's been a lot of fun. Our news story, two-thirds of a country away. So looking at some other craziness in the world of sports, because this is kind of our stock and trade, I guess, is the weird stuff. Last week, Negro Leagues, we had Bob Kendrick on. Always one of my favorite interviews, but saw something come across on Twitter about the 4th of July. And the only time that this is just a bizarre baseball footnote, and I have not verified it independently, but I assume that it's true because it makes sense. And it makes more sense simply because you get some great major league pitchers who never throw a no-hitter. And there are a good number of them that never did. And the other thing is, there aren't a ton of catchers in the Hall of Fame. But the only time that a battery is both in the Hall of Fame that worked together on a no-hitter, 1934 on Independence Day, Satchel Paige struck out 17 and walked one, and his battery mate was Josh Gibson, which is pretty sweet. And you, if you look at the major leagues now, there really isn't a whole lot of likelihood. You would need to get Madison Bumgarner, who isn't a lock by any means, throwing to Buster Posey, who again is not a lock by any means.
He's on the right track, though.
He is on the right track. He's got the World Series titles. Bumgarner's got the World Series titles. Like, both of those guys could be, but you would figure that it would have happened somewhere else, somewhere along the line.
Yeah, because in the 50s and 60s, you had so many great pitchers and dominant franchises like Dodgers and Yankees that had multiple Hall of Famers.
Right.
You know, you're more of a Dodgers expert, but guys like Sandy Koufax, Drysdale, long careers, no-hitter stuff.
But think about, I mean, and nothing wrong with John Roseborough, but he did not catch one. Or he was not a Hall of Fame catcher, I guess, as it were. You would figure you would get one with like a Whitey Ford and a Yogi Berra. Whitey Ford never threw one. It's a bizarre footnote. Look at the guys who've thrown them now. And that's the other thing. You get weird guys. You get Bud Smith throwing a no-hitter. Dallas Braden, like Len Barker. You get just weird dudes who get it all going for one day, and then you get guys who just never did, or when they did, they were throwing to a guy who was kind of their personal catcher, or it was the 90s when all the catchers hit 240 with about eight home runs a year.
Yeah, I mean, one that comes to mind for me is Randy Johnson, who did he throw six or seven He threw a bunch, and one of them was to Scott Bradley, who was my coach in college, and he was one of those personal catchers for a while. He wasn't an everyday starter, so you know he wasn't in the conversation of having a chance at the Hall of Fame. But for somebody like Randy Johnson to throw multiple no-hitters, it is a little bit surprising, but it goes to your point of there just aren't as many Hall of Fame catchers to choose from, and
That's the harder part, is putting that piece together. I think Randy Johnson, I think he only had one.
Oh, he only had one?
Yeah, he had a perfect game. Oh, no. He's one of seven pitchers who have thrown a perfect game and a no-hitter in their careers. But I don't know how many he had.
I may have gave him credit for multiple because he threw a perfect game.
That may be.
That's worth a couple no-hitters.
For that. But, and the 4th of July, always a great day for baseball. I heard a lot of fireworks. I did not actually see any.
Yeah, I saw some up in Maine, Bath, Maine. Great show.
Yeah.
My sister's family.
Yeah.
Rivaled Portland, Maine's fireworks show.
It's a good scenery for fireworks up there.
Yeah, it really was. Over the water. Very nice.
Our friends at the Fisher Cats had theirs on the 4th of July. And the city of Manchester had theirs going on the 3rd. So it was not for a lack of opportunity to do it. It was just a... complete epic fail on my part.
There were some fireworks on the field.
Yes.
In Milwaukee on the 4th. Did you see any of those highlights?
Which ones?
There was a special home run and a special catch.
I saw Keon Broxton's home run. Or Keon Broxton's catch. Is that what you're talking about? Okay.
Nothing like 4th of July. I mean, you mentioned the fireworks, but baseball too. It kind of goes hand in hand with the 4th of July. So what I saw in Milwaukee was kind of fun. This is what I wrote about it in haiku form.
Of course.
NL Best Brewers hoist Orf after round tripper.
Oh, I did see that, yeah.
Birth of a career. Broxton robs Dozier, lands on American soil, red, white, and blue socks.
I busted out the red, white, and blue socks on Saturday.
Doesn't surprise me.
Or on Saturday, on Wednesday, yeah.
Yeah, you've got those.
I know.
I've seen those before.
It's the way to go. They're awesome. I'd be wearing them now if I didn't look really weird dressed like that, but...
That was a nice combo of plays, though. You've got
Oh my God.
This guy Orf, who signed for $500 back in 2012, and he gets his first hit. So now he's 1-for-8. So he's off to a rough start, but his first hit is a home run down the line, and then two of his teammates actually hoist him up on their shoulders for the curtain call, and then Broxton just an incredible catch in center, and he comes down with the left sock is red and white. And the right sock is blue. And it did remind me of Lauren Fox's baseball gear.
So, yeah, the Nate Orf home run was cool. It always boggles my mind when you look at kids like that who get signed. And he was not a drafted player, I don't believe. He was an undrafted free agent out of Baylor. And they gave him $500 to be a roster filler. And he found his way to the major leagues.
Yeah, I mean,
nobody's going to take that away.
My experience interacting with guys like that is nobody expects them to get to the major leagues. You're right. They're a roster filler. The organizations view them as that.
Oh, the euphemism is the organizational player.
Right.
It's like Crash Davis was an organizational player. Too old to be playing in advanced day, which is what I assume the Durham Bulls were at that point in the hierarchy. Too old to be there. But he was there for a reason. He's there for the organization. He's not there so he ever goes to the major leagues. Those days are long gone. He's there because he's still young enough to play, still wants to draw a paycheck. So it's nice to see those guys get the opportunity. It's nice to see his teammates drag him back out of the dugout for a curtain call on Independence Day and lose their mind. So
yeah, it was.
There's that. I'd be derelict, too, if I wasn't mentioning Jeff Mosso and what he's doing down in Nashua. He's had a very good start to his career. And of course, the delineation is Nashua is a college wood bat team. And I never realized until I was talking to Rick Montine a few weeks ago, I never realized then they can get kids that have not yet gone to college. So I always thought it was, hey, this is like a bridge between freshman, sophomore, junior. But in the case of Jeff, he's out there throwing. He's doing very well for the Silver Knights. ERA under 4. In 14 innings, he's allowed 16 hits. And he's struck out 10 so far. So he has done well. They had a good interview with him on their Twitter feed. I believe that was on Independence Day as well. So, but it's just fun to have these names that we can follow and pay attention to, and I hope to make it down there to a game pretty soon as well.
Yeah, I saw that interview that you found on Twitter, and I think he had some sort of a camouflage shirt. Must have been a military July 4th type thing.
If it's Rick Muntean, you know there's some kind of promotion that involves jerseys. Yeah, the amount of stuff that the amount of stuff that I sold on eBay after I left the T-Bones that people were snapping up and paying good money for. It's crazy. That people would just walk into my office and be like, "Hey, we did Hawaiian night. Here's this jersey." And I left, and I'm like, I can make a few $100.
We'll see. With
get
that,
rid of this stuff.
With that experience, that's one more reason why the Grand Junction Rockies should be calling you.
Seriously, we need to. I want a shirt. I'm going to keep complaining until I get one. We'll see how that works for me. So, so moving on from baseball, I don't think the NBA season ever ended.
It has really just transitioned into summer league, NBA draft, free agency. It's great at being year round like the NFL. It's intense. There's a lot of big stuff happening.
Yeah, I really thought LeBron signing was just going to end it.
Kind of the first domino.
Yeah, it really was.
But that's where we got to start. He's on the Lakers. That part didn't really surprise me or anybody, I don't think.
No.
You know, there was a lot of chatter about him heading to the West Coast, wanting to be in that market. He has two houses in L.A. already. And then, you know, we talked a few shows back during the season, and at that point, I really thought the best fit for him would be Houston in terms of he wants to go out there and compete for a championship and finding a way onto the roster with Harden and Chris Paul would have been ideal. But turns out he and his family weren't that interested in living in Houston. You know, that's what I heard would be the main factor there. So instead, everybody in the family is excited about going to L.A. His kids can start playing on, you know, settle in with their high schools out there as they try to follow in dad's footsteps and make it to the NBA. And he's patient. He's ready to team up with Magic, made a 4-year commitment to the team. And, you know, he's put his faith in the purple and gold to build a winner and attract some big name talent. Just hasn't happened yet other than him.
So an interesting fact about LeBron that I saw, because of course I have the weird dichotomy of Boston fans who hate LeBron and LA fans who now love LeBron on my Facebook feed and on my Twitter.
And you've been a fan of both teams during your life.
And I've been a fan of both teams during my life. And you asked the question. I said Celtics.
The question was, in 3 years when they meet in the finals, who are you rooting for?
Yeah, it's tough. Hey, it's going to be tough for them to get out of the West, honestly. But growing up as a Laker fan, and people from here don't understand it, but the whole Showtime thing, having Magic, having Kareem, James Worthy, Michael Cooper, Byron Scott, like you had a roster that never changed. This whole full year free agency thing didn't happen. And you'd go out and you'd shoot in the backyard and you would be Michael Cooper because you were shooting threes and the 3-point line was about 80 feet then. And that was a big deal to hit that shot.
Right.
And Magic was and still is like he was just a beacon. Like and you can understand. So you look at LeBron and somebody shared something on Facebook earlier today saying, here's this guy who family man and 18 years old, signed for blank, net worth is now this. And he has sent 1,100 children to college on full scholarships.
You're talking about LeBron?
Yes.
Exactly.
That is astonishing. Astonishing. And you look at the exponential impact of sending 1,100 kids to college and what that does, just the domino effect that it has on their lives, getting better jobs, getting different jobs, emerging from college without debt. Like that. It's just like it's like you drop a pebble in a pond and see what happens. And that's the impact LeBron's made. But it's interesting. Magic, everybody is thinking of Magic, basketball, basketball, basketball. Magic Johnson with an estimated net worth of $500 million, with Magic Johnson Enterprises worth a reported $1 billion, Johnson is one of the most successful black businessmen in the U.S. Huh. Just saying.
Right.
Do you think LeBron, who is, I have nothing but admiration for the work that he has done in the communities and the fact that he's always reached out with hands to pull people up. Do you think that he's looking at this and saying, there's this guy, I can learn from this guy who, you know, Magic came out of, he was a smile when he graduated from Michigan State. I mean, when he came out of Lansing, like just a kid, look at Magic now.
Yeah, I do think that's part of it. I think there's two factors there that are important. It's A, he gets to go and observe Magic, learn from Magic, you know, be under Magic's wing in terms of being a mogul, being a businessman, having enormous influence on people outside of basketball. And the thing is, LeBron, as you described, is off to such a great start in that area. He doesn't really need it, but being around Magic can only help, whether it's with, you know, picking up things or, you know, just, you know, sort of networking and having different opportunities that he's excited about. But then the other part of it is just being in LA.
Yeah.
And he's going to be able to have a much bigger influence and a whole new group of opportunities by being in LA as opposed to being in Cleveland. So I do think that played into it.
So here's the story for you. This is funny. This is, my mom really enjoys this story. I was, I think, in seventh or eighth grade, and Magic Johnson was at a Dodger game and had the opportunity to meet him and went up and shook his hand and, Magic, it's a pleasure to meet you. Like, I'm meeting Magic, and this is like the heyday of Showtime when Pat Riley's talking about three-peat and all that. 10 minutes later, I find a $20 bill on the concourse at Dodger Stadium. And I was walking with my mom. I don't know if we used to always do this thing. We'd start on one level and make our way down, and then the game, you know, game would be close to its end, and like everybody else does in LA, and you leave. So we're going to walk out. I go to leave. I find this $20 bill, and like $20, dude. That's a lot of money.
For a seventh or eighth grader?
It'd be a lot of money now. And for a 44-year-old. And I look at my mom and I say, he really is Magic. So who knows?
Sprinkling 20s throughout just Dodger Stadium.
Maybe LeBron met him and found a $20 bill. That's all.
Well, in recent years, Magic has been sprinkling more than $20 bills around Dodger Stadium, you know, as part of the team trying to assemble a World Series winner and, you know, paying big bucks to do it. He did sprinkle a few 20s LeBron's way with a four-year deal for $153.3 million. So,
right.
But yeah, great story. And to think about Magic mentality, must have been a little bit different on that day. He probably wasn't thinking about running the Dodgers.
No.
At some point. He was just focused on winning championships. Yep. and watching a ball game.
Yeah, crazy. So, and then last night we had, speaking of crazy, we had some craziness on the court. Of course, you sent me that video on my phone. I didn't look at it. I assumed it was some, I assumed it was like highlights from the Eurobasket from like a fourth string point guard.
In Lithuania?
Yeah, in East Macedonia, who hit a shot from 73 feet or something. And then I looked at it closely later, and it was the same thing that I sent you, which is Grayson Allen and Trae Young.
Mixing it up.
I just threw up in my mouth a little bit.
Didn't take long. We've talked on this show about Grayson Allen's antics in college. And here we are, the first week of Summer League, after he's drafted as a first-round pick, and he gets tangled up in a very odd play.
Okay, but
with Trae Young.
That was always my thing with him, and we talked about this before, was he's playing defense for Duke, and it's this weird angle where I flail my leg out, and I'm like, what? I have never, ever seen anybody play defense on a guy at the three-point line that involves sticking your arm underneath the other guy's arm. Like, I mean, it basically, I think if you were to give Grayson Allen the happy gas and get the truth out of him, he would tell you that the reason he put his arm there was because he wanted Trae Young to retaliate so that he could then throw his hands up and act, oh, I had nothing to do with this. Like, play just, basketball. Just play basketball.
You can't make this stuff up.
Or be WWE, but don't be both.
It's just, it's taking Cheap Shot to a whole new level.
He's just a doofus.
You know, there's two things about this play that I didn't like. One is, he fouls Trae Young on the three-point shot, which is one thing, but he did so by having his arm over Trae Young's right shoulder.
It's a weird foul. So there's nothing natural about that play.
Weird foul to begin with.
And, you know, ask a dunker's probably listening to this. Like, I'm good at fouling. I know what fouls are.
Yeah.
that would never cross my mind. Hey, let me stick my arm around your arm because, like, I've grappled with enough people and screwed around like, hey, I'm just going to mess around with you. And you know what happens when I throw my arm over your arm? All you have to do is roll your shoulder back and I'm on my back on the ground because I've had that happen before. Like, that's not something that I would do in a rec league game.
But if it is, you would do it on a layup. You would do it under the hoop where you're really trying to prevent the guy from actually getting the shot off. Here, the foul is one thing. It's very unique and never seen it before. But then how he kind of flagrantly, you know, jostled his arm again to keep Trae Young's shoulder down and really risking injury for Trae Young.
Separate the kid's shoulder.
I mean, like, it's his shooting shoulder. And it was like a flagrant foul on top of his arm. It's a really unnatural movement. So that was problem number one. Problem number two is what you were talking about, how then he's bent over at the waist. And he takes a cheap shot by trying to basically bowl through Trae Young with his shoulder and hits him in the midsection. And then he puts his hand up like, oh, I didn't do anything. I mean, to me, it's like if you want to, you know, show your aggression, make some sort of statement, do it in a respectable way. Just, you know, push the guy. But don't take the cheap shot and then act like that's not what you were doing.
It's just like, you would have to believe that if somebody somewhere had administered some kind of personality test to him, you would have seen something that you just didn't like. And that's my thing with him is that you're too old. You're a college graduate at this point. And it's not like I get that people make mistakes and I get that like we all do it. Sometimes our aggressions get the better of us, but that just as a tiny piece of a summer league game, like really, like I seriously think the dude, he's probably a decent player. I think like, I'm just not a fan. And I honestly, you know, I have no desire to watch this kid play in the NBA. I don't want to hear his name. He's going to get cut, and I mean no disrespect to Tim Tebow, because Tim Tebow has turned into a good
redemption story
when he's not heading fly balls. Like, Tim Tebow's worked hard and been an all-around good guy, and I have no problem with that. What I have a problem with is this guy is just a colossal jerk. And victim, like, you can't play the victim if you're the one that instigated it. All the time. And we know because I can read your jersey and it says Allen on the back. I know it was you. Like, you can't tell me that's Sheldon Williams.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this is going to fly in the NBA.
No.
I think I saw somebody kind of take a cheap shot at him a little bit later in the game. So obviously, you know, Trae Young's teammates, they're going to have his back. And, you know, I heard one thing that surprised me is I heard an interview later in the game from Rudy Gobert, and he obviously hadn't seen all the replays because they asked, you know, what are your impressions of Grayson Allen so far? And one of the things he said was, you know, oh, he's tough. So he obviously saw that play as a teammate and thought, okay, well, this is a guy who's tough. He's not willing to back down. But I think if he actually saw the replay and as other NBA players watched the replay, it's now they're going to start paying attention to it. Maybe they didn't notice it as much when he was at Duke, but now they're going to see firsthand, who is this kid and why is he taking cheap shots at other stars? I mean, Trae Young was a top five pick, and you're not supposed to try and injure top five picks on a 3-point shot in summer league. You know, if it's the NBA finals on the line and he's going to the basket and you come in with a hard foul, okay. You know, the Kurt Rambis and Kevin McHale play, that's in the NBA finals. That's not in summer league, you know, in the third quarter at a meaningless moment. So that's not going to fly. And it's a shame that it's distracting us from the start of Summer League and, you know, other things like what you would be interested in, Trae Young, off to a very cold start.
So yeah.
The spotlight's going to be on him. The spotlight's going to be on the Hawks because they made that trade with Dallas where they took Doncic, sent him to the Mavs, and Mark Cuban was willing to part with a first-round pick for it. And the Mavs get their European successor to Dirk Nowitzki, which was probably the highlight of draft night was that trade between Atlanta and Dallas.
Right. It's it's still Summer League. And, you know, just the same as much as we all root for Grant Levine and we want Grant to tear it up for as long as he possibly can and ultimately get the call to the bigs, this is not a predictor of future success. It is merely an indicator of, hey, I've hit this checkpoint. I can move on to the next checkpoint. I can move on to the next checkpoint after that. But ultimately, you have to get into the crucible of the regular season or the postseason and perform. And on the flip side of it, though, you look at a Trae Young who is some guys have longer leashes than others. And what I mean when I say that is if you're a first round pick or a lottery pick, you have longer time to wash out than if you're a guy trying to make the roster. Speaking of baseball reference, the guy that I was looking at earlier today, because I was kind of researching the pitcher catcher thing, Lucas Giolito for the White Sox, who has given up more earned runs than anybody in baseball. Surprisingly, he's only 5-7, but his ERA is about 7. And you sit there and you say, why are teams continuing to throw Lucas Giolito on the mound? Well, he was the 16th pick overall. Like, everybody, we're all human beings, and we all look at a guy that's a first-round pick and go, somebody must have seen something that I'm not seeing. Okay. Well, I'll give him a chance. I'll throw him out there. And now he throws these great bullpen sessions. Let's see. We don't know what Trae Young's done in practice, anything like that. But if a guy is that high of a draft pick, they always have a little bit more chances because somebody looks and goes, yeah, there's something. There's just something. So, I mean, I would not make any case that Trae Young is going to fail. He was not my favorite to watch in college for a variety of reasons. But I wouldn't make a case that he would fail simply based on a little bit of Summer League.
Yeah, they're going to have a long leash for him. You know, he's a great shooter, so they're not concerned really that he's off to a cold start. You know, they're going to give him that leash, especially on the Hawks team that's going to be one of the bottom teams in the East. They're not going to win many games.
Right. I mean, so, he'll have ample opportunity to shoot the ball, pass the ball, do whatever, and like the other nice thing about being a guy like that is if you are a defensive stopper playing on a really garbage team, you're still going to be garbage because you're not getting help from the other guys. Trae Young is going to have the same advantage that a hitter playing on a bad baseball team does. Imagine what he would do with a great lineup and great people to play with and pass to. So that gives him longer of a leash.
Yeah, and I was watching the game last night. He made a number of great passes that did not end in baskets because his teammates, you know, didn't do their job. So he's going to have a long leash. And it's funny you mentioned the 16th overall pick in baseball because Chris Carpenter was the 15th overall pick in the first draft.
Yeah.
And he obviously had a leash. I mean, he did not start out as a Cy Young Award winner. He had to work towards it.
Yeah.
He had to battle through injury. And so we're gonna talk to him about that.
So the World Cup.
Has Fox watched any World Cup yet on Fox?
It was the Saturday after school ended. So the school ended on it was the 23rd. I watched the goal that Germany scored to beat Sweden in stoppage time.
That's right. You texted me about that one.
I have not watched anything else.
That was it. Do you know that Germany did not make
Germany
it to the knockout round?
Germany's out. So I know that.
Yeah.
I got that part.
Have you seen Mbappe for France?
No.
19-year-old who runs like the
I would have
wind.
Figured that Mbappe would be a natural to be Hansen's favorite player.
He's rocketed up
Mbappe. Mbappe.
Exactly. He's rocketed up the leaderboard of favorite soccer players for me.
I have not seen him. I wish that I could watch more World Cup. I walked into the other room last night because I heard the sweet sounds of baseball, and I got the Brewers and the Braves which was fun. Two teams that nobody thought were going to be there that have a bunch of young guys that are playing really well over their skates. And this Brewers team, oddly enough, this is their best record through, what was it, 78 games. They're like 53-35.
88.
Ties with two other teams, one of them being the 1982 team that lost the World Series to the Cardinals.
A team that included Robin Yount,
and Gorman
who
Thomas.
Was Chris Carpenter's first strikeout.
Really?
Major leagues.
There you go. It is also, yes, Sunday is Robin Yount Jersey Day at Miller Park in Milwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land. So, all right, that's it. That's just a Wayne's World quote. So we'll take a quick break. Come right back with Chris Carpenter. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox and Andrew Hansen, and we were just talking about this. Usually our guests are on the phone, half a world away or somewhere else, and this time we have a guest in the studio, but not just that. Bedford resident Chris Carpenter, former Cy Young Award winner. So, Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's going to be fun to be down here.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. You got a ball in your hand, and too bad we're not out on the field. I guess this is the next best thing. But... funny, we were talking about Grant Levine, and you know, you were a first round pick in the draft, started your minor league career in the Pioneer League, and that's where Grant is now. We're just talking about the hot start that he's off to. He's batting .390 with 3 homers and 15 RBIs. What advice would you give to him about making the transition to professional baseball?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely different, right? You're playing in New Hampshire baseball. You're not playing a ton of games, so one of it is you're playing a lot more games, but you're also playing against much better competition. And you can always go to the typical, you know, you got to work hard, make sure you set your goals, what you're doing, make sure you stay out of trouble, make the right decisions and those things. But for me, really, is just enjoy the experience. You don't get to that point, right? Grant's not going to be a first-round pick if he doesn't know how to work hard, if he doesn't have the talent to be good enough to be there. There's a reason why these guys see that, right? And they draft him that high. So he's going to do that. He's gonna work hard. He's going to get his work, and he's going to try to learn and do all those things that he does. But for me, it was thinking about when I go back to where I was then, now, is just enjoying the experience of what you're doing, understanding that you're in professional baseball and this is your journey now, and just try to take it all in, try to take those extra things in when you're traveling on the road and seeing these states and being in the middle. I remember driving through Billings, Montana, and Great Falls, Montana, and all these things going on, these long bus rides and seeing this beautiful area, and I just tried to take it all in. It was my first time away from home. Right, I didn't go to college or do anything like that, and it was just an enjoyable time in my life that I look back on, and I'm like, man, yeah, I've been to Montana, I've been to Wyoming, I've been to Utah, I've been to all these different places, but then on the backside, you got to make sure you work and make sure you set your goals to where you're going, because there was a lot of guys that had plenty of talent that weren't as motivated and was just enjoying or thinking that the Pioneer League was what it's all about, and it's not. Once you get going up levels, it gets better and better each way, and obviously when you get to the big leagues, it's the best. So,
yeah, and he's certainly, it makes it a little bit easier to have fun when you start off hitting .390. But yeah, I've driven through that part of the country too. It's beautiful, and so a good place to try and take in things and enjoy the moment. So, you know, you mentioned getting to the big leagues, and what were some of your secrets to success throughout your career to get to the level that you did?
Yeah, I mean, for me, one thing is, like I was just saying, I was never satisfied with where I was at. Like, I always wanted to keep moving. So it's a little different nowadays with how fast guys move. But, you know, I just wasn't satisfied. Pioneer League wasn't where I wanted to be. I wanted to enjoy the experience, but that's not where I wanted to be. I didn't want to be playing in the league. I wanted to be continually moving through the organization, because my ultimate goal and dream was to get to the big leagues. And one of those was one of the things that I did was I made sure that I kept that in mind. You know, while you watched other guys go out and do things like they were living in college, you know, messing around and doing things at night that you probably shouldn't be. I really put that on hold and just tried to take it as much the most advantage as I could of the opportunities that I had.
Now, one of the things you had to deal with as you were, you know, climbing the ladder and advancing, were injuries, and I saw that you had two surgeries between the end of the 2002 season and the beginning of 2004. How tough was it mentally to go through that process?
So it's difficult. One thing, it's hard and it's difficult to navigate through pitching sore and then getting to the point where it's more than sore and there's something wrong with you. So that was a difficult thing. My first surgery, I think, I had elbow surgery in 98 or 99 in the off season. Just get some cleanup in my elbow with some bone spurs and some stuff like that. But I've had seven total.
Wow.
And throughout my career. And what I did was I took some time to, woe is me and be mad at everybody in the world for why is this going to be me? Why am I hurt? And then I tried to do whatever I could to, one, make me physically stronger and mentally stronger throughout the rehab process. And so those 2 years was a real big year and change in my life. In 2002, I started opening day at Fenway Park against Pedro Martinez. I was the number one guy on our staff in Toronto. Me and Roy Halladay and Kelvin Escobar were supposed to be the guys that were going to take over the mighty Yankees and Red Sox, right, from Toronto, who couldn't make the playoffs from 93 when they last won. And so I started opening day 2002. And by the end of that season in September, I was in a sling surgery and was released. So you go from the highest of high to the lowest of low. And that year between 2002 and 2004, when I came back, was a growing year for me that, again, one, I got to the big leagues, and I think I was starting to take the big leagues for granted and how fast and how fleet that can go by and how quickly something can happen to where you lose your job. And that's what happened to me. And then I learned through that time to not take anything for granted, not to take any day for granted. And it really catapulted me into being the pitcher that I thought I could be and everybody else thought I could be too.
Did it ever get to the point where you thought about retirement, in the sense of I may not be able to get healthy again? I have multiple surgeries here. I may never get back to where I was. Did you ever think that you might not get back?
Yep, I did. And that was part of the growing process to me was, I was a 95, 96 guy before I had shoulder surgery. I came back and my first start, I'll never forget it. I was at home at Busch Stadium against the Houston Astros, and I was like 88 to 90. And I'm like, oh boy, this isn't going to cut it. I had to learn how to pitch and how to make pitches and how to mix speeds and all that stuff. And I was able to start learning that process. And then by the time halfway through the season my shoulder got healthy, I was back throwing 94 to 96. But I also knew how to pitch now and locate and do all those other things, and it made me better. There was definitely those times that off season in 02 and I didn't have a job and was released. I'm sitting there and I'm like crying in my house trying to figure out if my life was or my career was over, which again, what I was saying was a good move in a growing period in my life because it turned baseball not as important, but as important, if that makes any sense. Like right. My family and my children became more important. I wasn't all about baseball. So now I was like, let's go compete and see how good I can be. If I'm an average dude, that's fine. I mean, everybody in here would love to be an average guy in the major leagues, right?
and thankfully, you weren't. I mean, you figured it out. You won 15 games in 2004. Then you got injured again and missed that postseason when the Red Sox finally broke the curse and won the World Series against the Cardinals, and you weren't out there pitching. If you're out there pitching, maybe the Red Sox don't win the World Series.
I don't know about that. I would hate to say that it's all about me, but I definitely would have liked to see it. That year, I was throwing the ball well towards the end, and I was definitely getting back into where I needed to be. And I think it would have been a different series. Would they have won? I don't know. But dang, I was on both teams. I was hurt in 13 too. That was my last year. I tried to make a comeback after my thoracic outlet surgery, and I wasn't able to do it. So I missed both World Series against my hometown team growing up, which really stinks. I really wanted a chance to pitch against them in that, but it just didn't happen.
Well, in between those two series, you won two rings. You won in 06 against the Tigers, and then in 2011, you were the winning pitcher in Game 7 of the World Series against the Texas Rangers. What was that experience like?
I think about both World Series championships, and they're both two different teams, but you feel like a little leaguer, man. I won, when you win the championship when you're 12, or when I won the state championship when I was in high school at Trinity High School here in Manchester. All those feelings and that stuff comes back to you. It's just like winning anything when you were a kid, just on a grander stage. It was so cool. The Detroit one was great. And then that Texas one, you know, we had no chance. Everybody thought we had no chance against the Phillies. Everybody thought we had no chance against Milwaukee. And we just kept playing. And then we get to Texas in game six, which is one of the most epic games in the history of baseball, with Freezer hitting that homer to win it. And then we come back game seven and give me the opportunity on short rest. I ended up being able to throw pitch three games in that whole series, game one, five and seven, or one, four and seven. I can't remember which the middle one was, but it was just an unbelievable experience.
It's funny you mentioned David Freeze. I was watching the Dodgers and the Pirates the other day, and he comes up to bat, and I saw him play advanced A in the Cal League. I think it was 07 or 08, but it didn't take him long to get there. And every time I see the guy now, the only thing I think of is that 2011 series.
It's crazy.
Big homer.
That guy, man, did he have it. The whole playoffs.
Oh, dude, he was locked in.
The whole playoffs, he had an amazing playoffs that year, and it was just so much fun to watch. He's a phenomenal guy that works his butt off, and he's been through a lot of hardship throughout his life, and to see him get to that point and that level, man, was so cool.
So we're here with Chris Carpenter, former Major League pitcher, two-time World Series winner, and one thing, as I spend more time working with kids on pitching and just being around the game, even a lower level, is the mental side of pitching and the mental side of playing the game. And there is a lot of failure and there is a lot of success. How did you deal with success, failure, confidence, lack of confidence? You have a day where you just don't feel right, but you just got to go out and compete.
Yeah, and again, it comes with experience and learning, right? That's kind of where I'm at right now, and the role that I'm doing is trying to educate these kids, or at least give them some experiences that I went through. And, you know, I was just talking to Jack Flaherty, one of our guys, the other day when I was out there, and he was talking about how he has those games where he goes back and he can't fall asleep at night because you just start replaying that game over and over and over again. And then he goes out and pitched in Arizona. He got up a homer to Goldschmidt, to opposite field, to lose the game. It was one pitch. He was pitching great. And I get a text super late at night. And he's like, this is one of those games. And I get it. And what you do is you just continue to try to educate yourself on how to move forward, right? There's so much stuff that you have to deal with in this game. And you deal with failure, which is all the time. It's really hard to deal with success, that expectation level when they hand you the ball in game seven that they expect you to win or any other game. I mean, I got to the point where they're handing me the ball and they expected me to win every single time. So you just continue to practice and build confidence inside yourself. And it's just mental preparation, mental thought, mental talk, you know, like that positive talking in your brain. And I'll never forget, I was facing Roger Clemens in Houston, and he was over in Houston, and I beat him. And I was out running, doing my exercises the next day, doing our pulls, and he was out there running. And I had played with him in Toronto, and he whistles at me, and I can't remember what he called me, but he called me like some young something or whatever. And he's like, hey. And I was like, what? He's like, good one last night. And I was like, thanks. He's like, I just remember. He's like, once you do it once, he's like, they expect you to do it all the time, so you better be ready for it. And I learned with that, and I was. I got to the point where I wanted that ball in that situation at any time because I knew that I was able to mentally slow the game down, mentally control my emotions to be able to go out and compete and eliminate all the distractions that were around me.
That gets me thinking about the life of a pitcher in between starts. And with your success, you didn't have to deal with it as much as most. But what do you do over those 5 days if you have a bad outing because you can't go out the next day or 2 days later and you know, try and get things turned around? You know, were you a guy that would golf, or, you know, was it just sticking to the routine? You know, how did you deal with that, those 5 days, if you'd had a loss?
Yeah, so again, sticking to the routine over time, though. I mean, early on in my career, I stayed up all night. And the next day I came in and I was kicking rocks because I was pissed about the game before. But over time, and you start learning what that process is, and now, you know, you hear it all the time. If I only knew then what I know now,
of
right?
Course.
Towards the end of my career, I was like, man, if I could just keep my body healthy. I was got to the point where, I mean, mentally, I was able to do all that. And that's what I'm trying to share with these guys. As you get back, I would stick to my routine. Instead of evaluating each start, right? This is what I believe in, and this is what I get to, and this is what I preach to these kids. I used to evaluate each start. and be like, oh man, I shouldn't have hung that curveball. I should have done this or that, and all, you're going through this whole deal, right? And it, I got to the point where you don't evaluate each start, you evaluate the season. And if I just stick to the process, and that's, I go out and pitch and try to simplify and execute my pitches every game. And then the next day I wake up and start getting in my routine to prepare myself for my next one. I know, one, if you keep me healthy, if I stay healthy, and two, I do that, prepare properly, and you give me the ball 35 times, I'm going to win. I'm going to lose. There's going to be games that I'm going to lose, but the majority of the games, if I can mentally stick to that process throughout the season, I'm going to win.
That makes a lot of sense. Take the long view, and I'm sure you're sharing that with the Cardinals right now, and you've alluded a couple times to your current role, which is to be the special assistant to the president of the Cardinals. So what are your responsibilities like during the season in that role?
So this is the first year doing it. So really, he gave me a few things that he'd like me to work on, but really I'm trying to build relationships with the younger kids at the higher levels. So AA, AAA, and then in the big leagues, we had a lot of young guys in the big leagues that are really talented, love to work, and want to learn. So I'll go into like Memphis, which is our AAA team, or Springfield, which is our AA team, and spend 4 or 5 days there with these guys. And let's just talk. When we talk everything from being a dad, with young kids in the minor leagues to what it takes to locate a heater down and away in a big situation, to anything you can think of, working in between, mental thought processes that you go through. So in the minor leagues, it's trying to help them understand that and just share experiences. And when they ask questions, be open and honest with them, whether they like it or not. And then help them understand the transition. Because like I said earlier, kids seem to move so much faster. Now, you could be in AA at 22 years old and you could be in the big leagues the next day. Back in when I came up, you went level to level to level to level. And you had to prove yourself at a certain level before you move forward. So trying to share what is expected of them in the big leagues from our pitching coach, Mike Maddox, from our bullpen coach, Brian Eversgard, from what Mike Matheny thinks or wants, what our catchers are looking for, game planning, attacking hitters, attacking your work in between, all that other stuff. And just to make it a little easier for when they get up there to be like, oh man, I haven't seen this chart before, or this pregame ritual or routine, or how do I go through this, pitchers meeting and understand hitters and charts and all that other stuff. So we talk about that and just help them. At the big league level, I get dressed and kind of a third coach / whatever you want to call it, and just, again, talk pitch and talk baseball. They ask and share and do similar what I was doing at the end of my career.
Sounds like a lot of the intangibles of being a pitcher and successful pitcher. Are you spending any time watching video or talking with Cardinals pitchers about mechanics?
I do. So I'll stand in on their bullpens. I'll stand in and watch their games. I watch pretty much every Cardinals game, not all of them, but I watch a good amount of them, and I understand what they're doing, and I give them my 2 cents if I want to, and if they want to listen to it, that's fine. I make sure I know my role when I'm in the big leagues. Mike Maddox is the pitching coach, and he does a phenomenal job. What a great communicator and a great teacher he is. And I love being by his side and watching him work and hear some new things that he's been doing, and also have my thoughts of what I've been doing. And you go in and you just talk baseball and talk pitch, and that's how you learn. It's not always right, but they might not take what I like or what I do and be able to apply it. But if you at least get people talking and thinking about it, at least they're standing on the mound saying, hey, how can I fix this, or what can I do different to get better?
You mentioned Mike Matheny and, current manager of the Cardinals. When you played, Tony La Russa was the longtime manager of the Cardinals. What was it like playing for him? What was the clubhouse like in those days?
Yeah, very professional, just like he was, very prepared, just like he was. I mean, he was a simple guy to play for. He asked of you not to be late. He asked of you to work hard and try hard. His famous line was, you can never be perfect, but you can always try perfect. And he was super simple. Don't be late and work hard. Run the ball out. Play hard when you come between the lines and everything else, you do whatever you want to do. And I mean, it was just the way it was. And if you weren't, he held you accountable. He wasn't afraid to go walk up to Albert Pujols or Scott Rolen, as he was to me or anybody else, in front of everybody and say, hey, I need you to run harder. You didn't run that ball out. Or is there something wrong with you? Let me get you out of the game because you're not hustling. So he wasn't afraid. He held you accountable for everything you did. but he was very simple. He was just one of the most prepared men I've ever been around, which is what made him so great.
Well, you look at some of the teams he had before he was with the Cardinals, where I would say he had some of his biggest success. I mean, he had the A's teams in the late 80s, 90s, where you had some kind of crazy personalities mm-hmm. that if he had thrown a stack of rules at these guys, they would have said, forget it, I'm out. I have no interest in abiding by any of this. But by keeping it simple for them and for you, it can make it much, much easier to play for somebody like that, because you don't have to remember, okay, I have to, if this, then that. It's just simple. Don't be late, work hard.
Yeah, and you're right. But what he did was he got players in there that they understood it.
Right.
They were professionals, right?
Right? Yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
We didn't need rules.
Yeah.
You didn't have to tell me to make sure that I was in at a proper time.
Right.
Or I wasn't getting hammered the night before I was supposed to start.
Yeah.
You knew that.
Yeah.
He didn't have to hold a leash on us and make sure we're in curfew and all this other stuff. And if you didn't, if you were that guy that wasn't professional and couldn't do those things and you didn't fit in character-wise, see ya.
Yeah.
And then that's what happens is you start building teams like in Oakland. I played with Jose Canseco, and I know Mark McGwire. I mean, you meet Walt Weiss. I know Walt Weiss a little bit. Guys that could, I mean, really good players that you didn't have to throw all these rules at them.
Right.
They went and played, competed because they were professional, and we did the same thing as Cardinals when he was there. Scott Rowland said it perfectly last year. I was listening to him in an interview in St. Louis. He was in for a bobblehead or something, and he said, you know, when I was in my tenure with the Cardinals, we just had 25 guys that were the most professional guys I was around, and they knew what they were supposed to do. When we came to the ballpark, we were a bunch of professionals playing the game of baseball.
Well, you've mentioned three of the best right-handed hitters of all time, some of the biggest sluggers in Pujols, McGwire, and Canseco. So we're kind of curious, a couple of fun questions. Who was the toughest righty batter and toughest lefty you ever faced, guys that sort of kept you up at night in your game planning?
Yeah, Roberto Alomar, I would say, was probably the toughest lefty. You know, most guys, including Barry Bonds, you know, guys that, you know, you had mentioned Barry Bonds earlier before we got on the air. Most guys have areas that have weakness. And if you execute in those areas of weakness, you're going to get them out. And, you know, Barry had a hard time with the ball in on his hands. But if you missed by two balls on the plate, he was going to hit it into the bay.
Right.
So, I mean, guys have holes. Roberto Alomar, man, I mean, it just didn't seem like he had a hole, no matter if it was soft, hard, in, out, up, down. He was either able to foul it off or put a good swing on it for a line drive hit or something like that. So he was probably the most difficult to game plan for. Lee Stevens.
There's a solid one.
Yeah.
California Angel.
Yeah.
That's so a throwback.
Lee Stevens,
right there.
Then he played in Montreal and played in Texas too. He was he was famous, or one of the things he was famous for was he played first base like more than half the season for Rafael Palmeiro, and Rafael Palmeiro still won the Gold Glove in Texas that year. But Lee Stevens, man, he killed me. He was big left-handed white guy, first baseman DH type. I couldn't get him out no matter what I threw up. I felt like he was like 8 for 10 with like four homers, but I could not get him out. excuse me. And then right-handed, man, there was so many great right-handed hitters. Pudge Rodriguez was really good. Albert Bell was really good. Frank Thomas. There were so many really, really good right-handed hitters that were difficult. I couldn't pick one of those.
Now, how about when you were at the plate? You hit two home runs in the big leagues, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember those like they were yesterday?
Oh, absolutely. We were just talking about them last week when I was in St. Louis. So I was really bad. I was a good hitter in high school. Of course, everybody was a good hitter in high school, right? But then you get to the American League. There wasn't any interleague play at the beginning of my career, so we never hit. And then when there was interleague play when I was with Toronto, you'd have one series a year, and they'd throw you out there like the day before, get you some swings in BP, you'd go up and try to bunt, and you'd end up striking out three times. But then once you got to the National League, it was like, all right, we got to put some work in. And, man, that ball at 95 with movement is way different than high school at 82 and
right.
Not a whole lot of movement. But anyways, I was terrible at the beginning of my career, and over time I got better. And if you look at my numbers from the beginning of the NL and the end of NL, I was much better. And that's when I was able to hit my two homers. One of my greatest, or not greatest games, but my most fun games was the one that I hit one of my homers, and it was a grand slam in Cincinnati off Kip Wells. It was my last start of the year. We'd already clinched in September. So I knew I wasn't going to pitch a whole game. It was in 2009 or 2010, the year I won the ERA title, because they took me out after five innings knowing that I was going to clinch the ERA title.
Awesome.
I was 2-for-2 with 6 RBIs.
Wow.
I had a grand.
So that would be 09 because yeah. 10, you only had 4 RBI for the season.
Yeah. So, okay. So that game, Kip Wills, first inning, bases right. loaded, granny. I hit first base, arm up in the air, like again, like Little League. I was like, yes, this is the greatest thing ever. And then a couple innings later off Micah Owings, I hit a double down the line, right field line for a two RBIs and a two-run double. And it was a great game. 5 innings, no runs, 2-for-2 with 6 ribbies, take it to the showers and have a beer.
Dream awesome. Dream game right there.
Yeah. I was going to say, Micah Owings was one who could hit in his own
yes,
right,
he
too.
Could. Yeah, I think, like, he started hitting all the time after I got the double. He stopped pitching.
He raked.
Yeah.
Hey.
And then your second homer?
That was Mike Minor, lefty for the Braves. He's now was with Kansas City. I don't know where he's at now.
I don't know where he's now.
But he was a lefty with the Braves, young kid, opposite field in Atlanta. Fastball. Same. I had 2 hits that game, too. Opposite field homer that game, and then a changeup line drive base hit the next time up in that game off him.
Beautiful.
It's a solid career. Get a couple nukes out of the deal.
Yeah, that's great. I still I love
two World Series rings and two homers.
Yeah. Anything that we're talking about, the biggest smile he's had on his face is talking about
that
those.
Grand slam.
Oh yeah,
it was great. I'm telling you, man, I felt like I was 12.
Well, that's when you get to hit and you get to pitch,
it was great.
The deck is stacked in your favor.
Yeah.
Well, do you have anything else?
I'm good.
This was awesome. I could sit here all day and talk about 90s and 2000s baseball.
Oh, here you go. So could I.
But we really appreciate you coming in. Hopefully we can do it again soon, perhaps closer to the end of the season, and get you back in.
I'd love to. That'd be great.
It's really a lot of fun. Our guest has been Chris Carpenter. I'd like to take a moment and thank my co-host, Andrew Hansen. Thank everybody here at the studios at 10 Meeting House Road in Bedford. Chris, Bill, Harry, and Colleen for everything they do to help us get on the air. And catch you next week. Have a great week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.